Section B. After Dr. Haskell's procedure received public attention with ensuing and increasing public concern, bans on partial birth abortion proliferated. By the time of the Stenberg decision, about 30 states had enacted bans designed to prohibit the procedure. In 1996, Congress also acted to ban partial birth abortion. President Clinton vetoed the congressional legislation, and the Senate failed to override the veto. Congress approved another bill banning the procedure in 1997, but President Clinton again vetoed it. In 2003, after this court's decision in Stenberg, Congress passed the act at issue here. On November 5, 2003, President Bush signed the act into law. It was to take effect the following day. The act responded to Stenberg in two ways. First, Congress made factual findings. Congress determined that this court in Stenberg was required to accept the very questionable findings issued by the district court judge, but that Congress was not bound to accept the same factual findings. Congress found, among other things, that a moral, medical, and ethical consensus exists that the practice of performing a partial birth abortion is a gruesome and inhumane procedure that is never medically necessary and should be prohibited. Second, and more relevant here, the Act's language differs from that of the Nebraska statute struck down in Stenberg. The operative provisions of the Act provide in relevant part: any physician who in or affecting state, interstate or foreign commerce knowingly performs a partial birth abortion and thereby kills a human fetus shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 2 years or both. This subsection does not apply to a partial birth abortion that is necessary to save the life of a mother whose life is endangered by a physical disorder, physical illness, or physical injury, including a life-endangering physical condition caused by or arising from the pregnancy itself. This subsection takes effect 1 day after the enactment. B, as used in this section, 1, the term partial birth abortion means an abortion in which the person performing the abortion A deliberately and intentionally vaginally delivers a living fetus until, in the case of a head-first presentation, the entire fetal head is outside the body of the mother, or, in the case of a breech presentation, any part of the fetal trunk past the navel is outside the body of the mother, for the purpose of performing an overt act that the person knows will kill the partially delivered living fetus, and B, performs the overt act other than completion of delivery that kills the partially delivered living fetus, and 2, the term physician means a doctor of medicine or osteopathy legally authorized to practice medicine and surgery by the state in which the doctor performs such activity, or any other individual legally authorized by the state to perform abortions, provided, however, that any individual who is not a physician or not otherwise legally authorized by the state to perform abortions but who nevertheless directly performs partial birth abortion shall be subject to the provisions of this section. D1, a defendant accused of an offense under this section may seek a hearing before the state medical board on whether the physician's conduct was necessary to save the life of the mother whose life was endangered by a physical disorder, physical illness, or physical injury, including a life-endangering physical condition caused by or arising from the pregnancy itself. 2, the findings on that issue are admissible on that issue at the trial of the defendant. Upon a motion of the defendant, the court shall delay the beginning of the trial for not more than 30 days to permit such a hearing to take place. E, a woman upon whom a partial birth abortion is performed may not be prosecuted under this section for conspiracy to violate this section or for an offense under Section 2, 3, or 4 of this title based on a violation of this section. The Act also includes a provision authorizing civil actions that is not of relevance here. Part C. The District Court in Carhart concluded the Act was unconstitutional for two reasons. First, it determined the Act was unconstitutional because it lacked an exception allowing the procedure where necessary for the health of the mother. Second, the District Court found the Act deficient because it covered not merely intact DNEs, but also certain other DNEs. The Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit addressed only the lack of a health exception. The Court began its analysis with what it saw as the appropriate question, whether substantial medical authority supports the medical necessity of the banned procedure. This was the proper framework, according to the Court of Appeals, because when a lack of consensus exists in the medical community, the Constitution requires legislatures to err on the side of protecting women's health by including a health exception. The Court rejected the Attorney General's attempt to demonstrate changed evidentiary circumstances since Stenberg and considered itself bound by Stenberg's conclusion that a health exception was required. It invalidated the Act. Section D. The district court in Planned Parenthood concluded the act was unconstitutional because it posed an undue burden on a woman's ability to choose a second trimester abortion, was unconstitutionally vague, and required a health exception as set forth by Stenberg. The Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit agreed. Like the Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit, it concluded the absence of a health exception rendered the act unconstitutional. The court interpreted Stenberg to require a health exception unless there is consensus in the medical community that the banned procedure is never medically necessary to preserve the health of women. Even after applying a deferential standard of review to Congress's factual findings, the Court of Appeals determined substantial disagreement exists in the medical community regarding whether the procedures prohibited by the Act are ever necessary to preserve a woman's health. The Court of Appeals concluded further that the Act placed an undue burden on a woman's ability to obtain a second trimester abortion. The Court found that textual differences between the Act and the Nebraska statute struck down in Stenberg were insufficient to distinguish D&E and intact D&E. As a result, according to the Court of Appeals, the Act imposed an undue burden because it prohibited D&E. Finally, the Court of Appeals found the Act void for vagueness. Abortion doctors testified they were uncertain which procedures the Act made criminal. The Court thus concluded the Act did not offer physicians clear warning of its regulatory reach. Resting on its understanding of the remedial framework established by this Court in Iote versus Planned Parenthood of Northern New England, the Court of Appeals held the Act was unconstitutional on its face and should be permanently enjoined. Part 2. The principles set forth in the joint opinion in Planned Parenthood of Southeastern Pennsylvania versus Casey did not find support from all those who join in the instant opinion. Whatever one's views concerning the Casey joint opinion, it is evident a premise central to its conclusion that the government has a legitimate and a substantial interest in preserving and promoting fetal life would be repudiated were the court now to affirm the judgments of the courts of appeals. Casey involved a challenge to Roe versus Wade. The opinion contains this summary. It must be stated at the outset and with clarity that Roe's essential holding, the holding we reaffirm, has three parts. First is a recognition of the right of the woman to choose to have an abortion before viability and to obtain it without undue interference from the state. Before viability, the state's interests are not strong enough to support a prohibition of abortion or the imposition of a substantial obstacle to the woman's effective right to elect the procedure. Second is a confirmation of the state's power to restrict abortions after fetal viability if the law contains exceptions for pregnancies which endanger the woman's life or health. And third is the principle that the state has legitimate interests from the outset of the pregnancy in protecting the health of the woman and the life of the fetus that may become a child. These principles do not contradict one another, and we adhere to each. Though all three holdings are implicated in the instant cases, it is the third that requires the most extended discussion, for we must determine whether the Act furthers the legitimate interest of the government in protecting the life of the fetus that may become a child. To implement its holding, Casey rejected both Roe's rigid trimester framework and the interpretation of Roe that considered all pre-viability regulations of abortion unwarranted. On this point, Casey overruled the holdings in two cases because they undervalued the state's interest in potential life. We assume the following principles for the purposes of this opinion. Before viability, a state may not prohibit any woman from making the ultimate decision to terminate her pregnancy. It also may not impose upon this right an undue burden, which exists if a regulation's purpose or effect is to place a substantial obstacle in the path of a woman seeking an abortion before the fetus attains viability. On the other hand, regulations which do no more than create a structural mechanism by which the state or the parent or guardian of a minor may express profound respect for the life of the unborn are permitted if they are not a substantial obstacle to the woman's exercise of the right to choose. Casey, in short, struck a balance. The balance was central to its holding. We now apply its standard to the cases at bar. Part 3. We begin with a determination of the Act's operation and effect. A straightforward reading of the Act's text demonstrates its purpose and the scope of its provisions. It regulates and proscribes, with exceptions or qualifications to be discussed, performing the intact D&E procedure. Respondents agree the Act encompasses intact D&E, but they contend its additional reach is both unclear and excessive. Respondents assert that, at the least, the Act is void for vagueness because its scope is indefinite. In the alternative, respondents argue that the Act's text proscribes all D&Es. Because D&E is the most common second trimester abortion method, respondents suggest the Act imposes an undue burden. In this litigation, the Attorney General does not dispute that the Act would impose an undue burden if it covered standard D&E. We conclude that the Act is not void for vagueness, does not impose an undue burden from any overbreadth, and is not invalid on its face. Section A. The Act punishes knowingly performing a partial birth abortion. It defines the unlawful abortion in explicit terms. First, the person performing the abortion must vaginally deliver a living fetus. The Act does not restrict an abortion procedure involving the delivery of an expired fetus. The Act, furthermore, is inapplicable to abortions that do not involve vaginal delivery, for instance, hysterotomy or hysterectomy. The Act does apply both pre-viability and post-viability because, by common understanding and scientific terminology, a fetus is a living organism while within the womb, whether or not it is viable outside the womb. We do not understand this point to be contested by the parties. Second, the Act's definition of partial birth abortion requires the fetus to be delivered until, in the case of a head-first presentation, the entire fetal head is outside the body of the mother, or in case of a breech presentation, any part of the fetal trunk past the navel is outside the body of the mother. The Attorney General concedes, and we agree, that if an abortion procedure does not involve the delivery of a living fetus to one of these anatomical landmarks, where, depending on the presentation, either the fetal head or the fetal trunk past the navel is outside the body of the mother, the prohibitions of the Act do not apply. Third, to fall within the Act, the doctor must perform an overt act other than completion of delivery that kills the partially delivered living fetus. For purposes of criminal liability, the overt act causing the fetus's death must be separate from delivery, and the overt act must occur after the delivery to an anatomical landmark. This is because the Act proscribes killing the partially delivered fetus, which when read in context refers to a fetus that has been delivered to an anatomical landmark. Fourth, the Act contains scienter requirements concerning all the actions involved in the prohibited abortion. To begin with, the physician must have deliberately and intentionally delivered the fetus to one of the Act's anatomical landmarks. If a living fetus is delivered past the critical point by accident or inadvertence, the Act is inapplicable. In addition, the fetus must have been delivered for the purpose of performing an overt act that the doctor knows will kill it. If either intent is absent, no crime has occurred. This follows from the general principle that where scienter is required, no crime is committed absent the requisite state of mind. Part B. Respondents contend the language described above is indeterminate, and they thus argue the Act is unconstitutionally vague on its face. As generally stated, the void for vagueness doctrine requires that a penal statute define the criminal offense with sufficient definiteness that ordinary people can understand what conduct is prohibited and in a manner that does not encourage arbitrary and discriminatory enforcement. The Act satisfies both requirements. The Act provides doctors of ordinary intelligence a reasonable opportunity to know what is prohibited. Indeed, it sets forth relatively clear guidelines as to prohibited conduct and provides objective criteria to evaluate whether a doctor has performed a prohibited procedure. Unlike the statutory language in Stenberg that prohibited the delivery of a substantial portion of the fetus, where a doctor might question how much of the fetus is a substantial portion, the Act defines the line between potentially criminal conduct on the one hand and lawful abortion on the other. Doctors performing D&E will know that if they do not deliver a living fetus to an anatomical landmark, they will not face criminal liability. This conclusion is buttressed by the intent that must be proved to impose liability. The Court has made clear that scienter requirements alleviate vagueness concerns. This Court has long recognized that the constitutionality of a vague statutory standard is closely related to whether that standard incorporates a requirement of mens rea. The Act requires the doctor deliberately to have delivered the fetus to an anatomical landmark. because the doctor performing a D&E will not face criminal liability if he or she delivers a fetus beyond the prohibited point by mistake, the act cannot be described as a trap for those who act in good faith. Respondents likewise have failed to show that the act should be invalidated on its face because it encourages arbitrary or discriminatory enforcement. Just as the act's anatomical landmarks provide doctors with objective standards, they also establish minimal guidelines to govern law enforcement. The scienter requirements narrow the scope of the act's prohibition and limit prosecutorial discretion. It cannot be said that the act vests virtually complete discretion in the hands of law enforcement to determine whether the doctor has satisfied its provisions. Respondents' arguments concerning arbitrary enforcement, furthermore, are somewhat speculative. This is a pre-enforcement challenge where no evidence has been or could be introduced to indicate whether the act has been enforced in a discriminatory manner or with the aim of inhibiting constitutionally protected conduct. The act is not vague.